Due to the graphic nature of this dictator's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of murder and genocide. We advise extreme caution for children under 13.
In March 1982, Somali President Mohamed Siad Barre met with U.S. President Ronald Reagan, who considered Somalia a critical ally in the hostile Persian Gulf.
Barre claimed he needed money to defend his country from a potential Ethiopian attack. So Reagan approved the delivery of $90 million and a cache of weapons.
But despite the friendly meeting, Barre and Reagan didn't trust each other. Barre thought Reagan could afford to give Somalia more aid. Reagan thought he was already giving plenty, and he wasn't sure what Barre was doing with the cash.
Then, at a press conference following their meeting, Barre complained to the reporters that he was being shortchanged. He warned that the enemies of the U.S. government, the Soviet Union and Cuba, were allied with his enemy, Ethiopia.
However, Reagan assumed that Barre's concerns about Ethiopia were just bluster. And a few months later, he was proven right.
Instead of using the aid money and arms for Somalia's defense, Barre stole the cash and turned the weapons on his own people.
It was the beginning of a reign of terror that left a bloodstain on the history of Somalia forever.
Welcome to Dictators, a Spotify original from Parcast. I'm Richard.
And I'm Kate. You can find all episodes of Dictators and all other Spotify originals from Parcast for free on Spotify.
Today we're exploring the life of Siad Barre, the dictator of the Somali Democratic Republic from 1969 to 1991. Driven by a personal tragedy to eliminate clan factionalism, Barre sought to unite Somalia under his tenets of scientific socialism.
But his early successes were undermined by a misguided war with Ethiopia and ill-conceived social policies. These led to economic ruin, genocide, and Barre's abandonment of his principles in a desperate bid to cling to power.
We'll have all that and more coming up. Stay with us.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on-a-whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Siad Barre was born in 1910 in the town of Shalabo, now part of eastern Ethiopia. Little is known of his early life, except that he came from a nomadic family of shepherds.
At the time of his birth, the country was split into two colonies, Italian Somaliland and British Somaliland. Like much of Africa, the region was also divided into indigenous clans that had designated social and political identities.
Barre's clan, the Darod, lived along the border between the two colonies. The other prominent nomadic clans in the region were called the Isak, Deer, and Hawiya. Relations between the clans were tense, and feuds often dated back hundreds of years.
These feuds frequently led to violent clashes between the groups and with colonizers. It's rumored that at around age 10, Bera witnessed his father's murder during a battle with Europeans. Not long afterward, his mother was also killed in a separate clan conflict.
The deaths of his parents had a profound impact on young Bera and instilled in him a deep desire to eliminate clan factionalism in Somalia.
This desire would guide his choices for the rest of his life.
Despite the hardships of his youth, he pursued an education well into his teenage years.
After finishing his studies in his late teens or early 20s, he joined the Italian colonial police. Later, he signed up for the British Gendarme, a military unit in charge of policing civilians.
Bera had a particular story he liked to share from his gendarme days, one which left a deep impression on him.
One afternoon, Bera and a group of soldiers were assembled in the barracks preparing to leave for school in Kenya.
Suddenly, a young gendarme called out that someone had stolen his hat. He demanded that the commanding officer on duty search everyone present.
But the officer refused, telling the gendarme, "Let the clever man have two hats while the fool goes without."
The thief was never found, and the gendarme went without his hat. That day, Bera realized something fundamental about himself. He wanted to be the man with two hats. To him, being clever meant taking what he wanted, lest he be the one left without.
So he set his sights on ascending the military ranks and spent the first half of his life earning one promotion after another.
But in 1960, 50-year-old Bera's army career was overshadowed by an even more exciting development. That July, Britain and Italy relinquished their colonies, leaving the region free to govern itself. Somalia was officially independent.
However, the new Somali-led government struggled to find its footing. It was daunting to create a government from scratch in a country divided into clans.
The rise of small, disconnected political parties and a lack of organization resulted in constant government turnover. This made the new bureaucratic system appear weak and incompetent, which led to widespread corruption and nepotism.
Worst of all, without the support of a Western government, the country suffered severe economic hardship.
Somalia lacked any significant natural resources, so most of the economy relied on cattle grazing. This wasn't exactly a boon for domestic or international trade.
On top of these problems, the vast majority of Somali citizens were illiterate. Most remained stuck in a cycle of poverty. Within just a few years of the end of colonial rule, it seemed Somalia was in deep trouble.
But for Bera, things were going fine. In 1965, the 55-year-old was promoted to army commander in the Somali army.
Around this time, Somalia accepted much-needed military training from the Soviet Union. This partnership led Bera to embrace Marxism-Leninism.
This ideology advocated for a more united society than Somalia's traditional clan-based structure. This idea undoubtedly appealed to Bera, whose parents had been killed by warring clans. He'd also experienced firsthand his country's political and economic woes under factional leaders.
Along with many of his fellow soldiers, Bera decided that Marxism-Leninism was the key to saving his country from a corrupt and inefficient government.
While it's unlikely that many Somalis outside the military ranks subscribe to this specific ideology, most everyone in Somalia was hoping for some kind of change.
That change came abruptly on October 15, 1969, when the Somali president was assassinated. The killer was one of his own bodyguards, who was almost certainly motivated by clan politics.
In the aftermath of the killing, a new president was chosen by members of the government. However, he belonged to the same clan as the man who had just been killed. For many, this was confirmation that the cycle of nepotism and corruption was doomed to continue.
The Somali military finally decided to take matters into its own hands. On October 21st, a group of 24 Marxist army officers, calling themselves the Supreme Revolutionary Council, or SRC, launched a coup.
Facing little to no resistance, SRC soldiers took over strategic locations in the capital, Mogadishu. Upon seizing power, the SRC suspended the constitution and arrested leading members of the government.
While several officers had orchestrated the coup, 59-year-old Berra quickly emerged as the SRC's commander. Just days later, the group chose Berra as the country's president.
Somalia was renamed the Somali Democratic Republic, and the SRC announced its goal of ending factionalism, nepotism, and corruption once and for all.
Initially, they remained true to their word. The SRC began a robust crusade to fight corruption, raise the standard of living, and fix the economy.
Young soldiers and police officers replaced provincial governors and were tasked with balancing their budgets. Any officials even suspected of corruption were arrested.
To tackle endemic poverty, thousands of unemployed Somali citizens were given food and clothing and put to work on farms and public construction projects. This initiative not only provided the bare necessities, but a much-needed sense of dignity and pride.
With their plan in place, the SRC retroactively declared their coup a Marxist revolution. The new government's young ideologues looked to the Soviet Union for inspiration and practical assistance in reshaping their nation.
Filled with Marxist-Leninist spirit, Berra announced the introduction of a new state ideology a year after the coup. He called it scientific socialism.
In the philosophical sense, the goal of a socialist society is to eliminate class conflict. Berra's new ideology was to eliminate clan conflict. After all, this factionalism had killed his parents and shaped his early life.
In his view, this regressive tradition encouraged lawlessness and aggression. This held the country back, and Somalia needed to become a nation with modern laws.
To that end, the SRC outlawed the payment of blood money. Traditionally, this was the compensation paid by a clan to the family of a murdered person.
Instead, the government announced that all murderers would now be put to death. Berra believed that if this threat didn't stop the blood feuds, then nothing would.
Besides the ban on blood money, the SRC replaced village leaders who received a government salary. In their place, the government appointed elders called peace seekers, whose job was to create unity across the clans.
Berra and the SRC seemingly had grand plans for Somalia's future as a socialist nation. However, revolutionizing an entire society virtually overnight was far more complex than the SRC expected, especially in terms of economics.
Crucially, the SRC nationalized two of the country's only profitable industries, banana and sugar production. This backfired as the systems became horribly mismanaged. Sugar supply, in particular, couldn't even meet domestic demand.
The government also waded into other agricultural failures. Misguided attempts to control the price of wheat harmed profits, which meant farmers stopped growing it. Instead, many turned to watermelon production, which was not as heavily regulated. Thus, the economy continued its downward spiral.
Initially, most of the public supported Berra's coup. But while his regime made some progress combating factionalism, the economic policies were clearly unsuccessful. After 3 years, prosperity remained elusive for many Somalis.
With public optimism fading, Berra shifted his focus toward foreign conquest to bolster his regime. In doing so, he would transform Somalia not into his socialist utopia, but rather A Hell on Earth.
Coming up, Bera embraces new totalitarian methods.
What could be more shocking than uncovering the dark secrets behind history's biggest stories? Realizing that everything you thought was true was a lie. Hi, it's Molly from the Parcast series Conspiracy Theories. Each week, we take a closer look at the blurred line between fact and fiction, revealing that there may be more to the so-called truth than you think. The rise and fall of J. Edgar Hoover, 75 years of Roswell, the tragic death of Princess Diana. On Conspiracy Theories, we leave no stone unturned and no skeptic unheard. Some may be just outlandish claims. Others may make you rethink everything. Follow the Spotify original from Parcast Conspiracy Theories. Listen free, only on Spotify.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Now back to the story.
In 1969, 59-year-old Siad Barre helped instigate a coup to overthrow the Somali Republic's democratic government. Within days, he was appointed president, and he used the office to make himself the nation's supreme leader. Later that year, he instituted scientific socialism, a policy to combat clan factionalism and modernize Somalia.
But when enthusiasm for the new regime waned, Barre took inspiration from the likes of Stalin, Mao Zedong, and Kim Il-sung. He turned to a trusted method of oppression, the cult of personality.
Somalia's state-controlled media officially dubbed Barre with a series of glorious nicknames, including the Victorious Leader, Beneficent Leader, and Father of the Nation.
Privately, Somalis had another nickname for Barre. They called him Big Mouth. This moniker was inspired by his habit of long-winded, yammering speeches.
In the tradition of Mao, Barre's catchphrases were collected into a little red book-style pocket manual. The Somali version was blue and white, the colors of the national flag.
But Barre's catchphrases were far from inspiring. A typical example read, quote, "Less talk and more work."
From Kim Il-sung, Barre stole the practice of mandatory dance choreography. During carefully orchestrated public appearances, he forced Somali subjects to dance before him with moves lifted from North Korea.
Like any communist dictatorship, the revolution had to infiltrate every aspect of a comrade citizen's life. To expand the reach of Barre's image cult, he created the Political Office of the President, which opened orientation centers across the country. He expected citizens to sacrifice their public holidays to visit them and receive revolutionary indoctrination.
However, Barre found it particularly difficult to reach Somalia's enormous population of nomads. To bring them into the revolutionary fold, the SRC forcibly resettled over 100,000 nomads on farms and in coastal towns.
Even the country's elite weren't exempt from re-education. They had to sit through training courses run by the Somali Institute for Development Administration.
Meanwhile, the National Security Service, whose commander was trained by the Soviet KGB, monitored the activities of government officials. Those found lacking the appropriate level of revolutionary fervor were arrested.
Finally, to prevent the spread of dangerous ideas, Barre strictly curtailed Somalis' rights of assembly and association with foreigners.
Barre provided the stick, but also wanted to offer a carrot. So in 1973, he decided to improve Somali lives by launching a mass literacy campaign. Even government officials weren't exempt.
The adult literacy classes became immensely popular and drew huge crowds eager to learn.
Following the literacy program's popularity in the cities, Berra's government extended the program to the nomadic population. In 1974, it spent millions of dollars to send 30,000 students and teachers into the interior of the country.
Berra's goal was to have the entire country literate within 2 years. Quite a tall order, since the literacy rate was estimated at a mere 5%. Berra even provided a campaign slogan with, quote, "If you know, teach. If you don't, learn."
For Berra, mass literacy was not only a means of modernizing the country, but essential in eradicating factionalism. In a speech he gave in March 1974, Berra said, "Literacy will bring about an absolute unity."
Despite the complex challenge, Berra's literacy program was considered a rousing success, with literacy rates climbing between 24 and 70%. In fact, the campaign became the clearest indication that Berra's scientific socialism might actually be helping Somalia.
It proved that the country could be transformed for the better. Despite his cult of personality and earlier missteps, Berra seemed as if he were truly committed to improving the lives of his people. Unfortunately, the program was derailed by an event no one could have foreseen.
Beginning in 1974, Somalia faced one of the worst droughts in its history. The lack of water hurt already fragile crop yields and resulted in widespread famine.
Berra and the SRC launched a campaign to combat the famine, which fell hardest on the nomadic population. After this massive reallocation of state resources, the literacy program never got back on track.
The crisis also threatened Berra's base of power. This prompted him to reorganize the government so it seemed more legitimate, as though Berra ruled with the people's consent. So on July 1, 1976, he dissolved the SRC and created the Somali Socialist Revolutionary Party.
Until this point, Berra had concentrated his energies on consolidating his power and fighting the internal problems of factionalism, nepotism, and corruption.
However, by 1975, with the drought mercifully behind them, he felt strong enough to start flexing muscle in the foreign arena. With a new government in place, Berra looked to expand his power further by taking control from his neighbors.
There were three potential targets for Berra to seize territory: the neighboring nation of Djibouti, which the French still controlled, the northern frontier district of Kenya, and the Ogaden in Ethiopia. Each region had enclaves of Somali people, but weren't part of Somalia itself.
Seizing control of these lands was the dream of pan-Somali nationalists ever since European colonizers haphazardly drew their borders. Now, to form a greater Somalia, Berra believed it was time to act.
Since Djibouti was still a French colony, Berra felt it was an ideal location to focus his new energies in the name of anti-imperialism. He extended material and financial support to a paramilitary group known as the FLCS, who made several successful incursions into Djibouti.
But in February 1976, the FLCS hijacked a school bus carrying 30 French children. Military snipers flew in from Paris and killed the terrorists, but not before an FLCS gunman opened fire, killing a child and wounding six others.
After the attack, relations between France and Somalia turned sour. Support for the FLCS evaporated, as did Berra's hopes of forcing unification with Djibouti.
But Berra was undeterred. He still wanted to appear mighty on the international stage. So in 1977, he turned his attention to Ethiopia.
Not long before the debacle in Djibouti, a communist military group called the Derg overthrew the Ethiopian government. Ethiopia was subsequently plunged into chaos, offering Bera a perfect opportunity to exploit the crisis.
For years, Muslim Somalis in Ethiopia's Ogaden region had protested for independence. Bera backed the Western Somali Liberation Front, or WSLF, a Somali separatist group there.
Beginning in June 1977, Bera encouraged the WSLF to attack Ethiopian garrisons. The Derg condemned Somali involvement, calling it an invasion.
Other African nations attempted to mediate a ceasefire, but Abdurrahman Jama Bera, Siad's cousin and foreign minister representing Somalia, had grown overconfident after the success of the WSLF and stormed out of the talks when his suggestion of a liberation movement in the WSLF wasn't accepted. This derailed the chance for peace and infuriated neighboring leaders.
Bera hoped to receive military and financial support for the conflict from the Soviet Union, but they were hesitant to back him. However, he did receive help from Saudi Arabia, whose government offered him what would be a $641 million arms deal.
Forced to choose between two Marxist states, Somalia and Ethiopia, the Soviets backed the latter. They sent tanks, fighter planes, and other heavy weapons to the Ethiopian military.
However, this Soviet assistance yielded few results on the battlefield. The Somali WSLF continued capturing towns in the Ogaden and seemed poised to take over the entire region.
Feeling confident, Bera officially cut all ties with the Soviet Union on November 13th. He gave the 6,000 Soviet military and civilian personnel in Somalia a week to leave the country.
At home, Somalis embraced the war effort against their old rival Ethiopia. Workers took leaves of absence to join the WSLF and fight for their nation. By late November, WSLF fighters were on the verge of capturing the strategically important city of Harar.
However, strengthened by Soviet arms and advisors, the Ethiopian military repelled all attempts to take the city. The Ethiopian Air Force, which bombed targets in northern Somalia, was particularly devastating.
Bera turned to the U.S. and NATO, but they offered aid only on the condition that Bera abandon his socialist plans for Somalia, which the dictator refused to do. He didn't realize this arrogance would cost him everything.
In early March 1978, less than a year after the war began, an Ethiopian division flanked WSLF forces in the north. They caught the Somalis by surprise and quickly overwhelmed their forces.
On March 9th, a crestfallen Bera announced the withdrawal of Somali forces from the Ogaden.
With the war at an end, not only had Bera lost the support of the Soviet Union, his dream of expanding Somalia's borders was dashed. It seemed his downfall had begun.
Coming up, Bera's defeat threatens his hold on power.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at ikea-usa.com today.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Now, back to the story.
In July 1977, 67-year-old Somali dictator Siad Bera invaded Ogaden in neighboring Ethiopia. He hoped to expand his nation's borders, but less than a year later, Somali forces were overrun and Berra's troops were forced to retreat.
This defeat shattered Berra's reputation and his dreams of a greater Somalia. Plus, he lost the support of the Soviet Union, his only major ally.
Berra's hold on power was weaker than ever, and some disgruntled Somali soldiers saw that as an opportunity.
In mid-1978, during the immediate aftermath of Berra's Ogaden defeat, Somali forces along the southern border attempted to overthrow him. Berra gathered troops loyal to him and put down the coup, resulting in 500 deaths.
After the coup attempt, Berra knew he had to tighten his control over Somalia. He ordered the directors of every government agency to undergo 5 months of re-education in a Mogadishu orientation center. This long-term measure crippled the government's productivity in the wake of the Ogaden disaster.
Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of ethnic Somali refugees fled the Ogaden to settle in Somalia. This surge increased the national population by a full 20%.
Berra's regime did manage to cobble together refugee camps and pleaded for international aid from Western nations. But until this charity arrived, Somalia had to cover the costs, and very little remained in the treasury after a disastrous war.
Amid the refugee crisis, Berra also struggled to manage his own regime. The government was reorganized again in 1979, and the following year, Berra declared a state of emergency and revived the Supreme Revolutionary Council.
As usual, Berra did this to make it look like substantive changes were afoot. In reality, his moves were nothing but smoke and mirrors, but he used the ruse to his benefit on the international stage.
In 1982, Berra met with Ronald Reagan and claimed that Ethiopia, Russia, and Cuba still posed a threat to Somalia. He demanded immediate financial and military aid, but Reagan wasn't buying it.
While the U.S. president eventually gave some meager support, it was only because Somalia was virtually the only U.S. ally in the Persian Gulf at the time.
And when Berra returned home, much of the aid money he received went straight into his personal coffers. He also used the funds to shore up his power, mostly by hiring additional security forces and expanding his cult of personality in the media. But these efforts did little to quell the growing unrest in Somalia.
By 1985, Berra's support among the Somali public was plummeting. The more it fell, the more he began to rely on his last bastion of support, his Darid clan.
This endorsement antagonized the country's other clans, further diminishing Berra's popularity. He'd risen to power by seeking to eliminate factional divides, but now it seemed he would encourage factionalism to hold on to power.
In response, other clans formed armed resistance groups. The Majerton clan organized guerrilla fighters in a unit called the Somali Salvation Democratic Front, or SSDF. A year later, the SSDF moved its headquarters to Ethiopia, which was happy to host Berra's enemies.
Meanwhile, another clan, the Isak, helped assemble a second rebel militia called the Somali National Movement, or SNM.
Berra fought back immediately. The dictator unleashed his wrath and sent his troops to target Isak and Majerton towns. However, this use of force only served to weaken his image at home and abroad.
By 1986, with internal problems piling up, Berra again shifted his focus to the international stage, hoping to salvage his reputation. He met with Ethiopian leader Mengistu Haile Mariam to improve relations.
While the meeting seemed productive, by the following year, border clashes had resumed. Some even believed Berra intentionally provoked the clashes as a ploy to garner more military support from the U.S. and NATO.
But the additional support did little to ease Berra's troubles. The problems unleashed by the Ogaden War never seemed to fade. And as the years went by, it became more difficult for Berra to confront them effectively.
While it seemed like things couldn't get any worse in the political arena, Berra's physical health was also deteriorating.
On May 23, 1986, he was involved in a nasty car crash. Berra was in his early 70s and suffering from diabetes, but somehow managed to survive the ordeal.
However, while Berra was recuperating in Saudi Arabia, the Somali vice president declared a state of emergency.
This led to the formation of two competing groups. On one side were the vice president and other leading politicians. On the other side were members of Berra's clan and his family, including his first wife and eldest son.
With the two sides bickering publicly, Berra returned to Somalia in June 1986. The brush with death made Somalis aware of Berra's mortality, and many began to wonder who would succeed him.
Berra tried to give the impression that he wasn't going anywhere. In November 1986, he ran unopposed for another term. The elections that December saw Berra win 99.9% of the vote. But behind the scene, the two factions continued to vie for power.
Since Berra favored the faction dominated by his ancestral clan, the Darud, he rewarded them with promotions to senior military ranks. This included replacing the vice president in the Ministry of Defense with a Darud clansman.
The victorious leader's old rhetoric about the dangers of factionalism was now fully exposed as hypocrisy. By this point, Berra openly favored his clan to hold on to power. But even this desperate gambit would only yield a temporary security.
By the summer of 1987, the Somali economy was in dire shape. Inflation was unmanageable, and the monthly wages of a typical civil servant couldn't even cover a week's rent. Foreign aid was now necessary to provide basic food. At one point, this aid even constituted a full two-fifths of Somalia's GDP.
In August, the rampant inflation led to riots in the capital, Mogadishu. And although Berra was able to suppress them with the help of the military, it was clear that Somalia was spiraling out of his control.
Then, in 1988, foreign journalists exposed Berra's human rights abuses to the world. The journalists also uncovered that Berra was stealing millions of dollars of international aid meant to feed refugees and jumpstart the economy.
Meanwhile, the military equipment provided by the U.S. was being used against Somali citizens. Berra used the military as his personal security force and ordered them to arrest and torture any perceived enemies.
The UNHCR went back and forth with the Somali government to make sure that they weren't aiding in a political war. And as a result, refugees in the north suffered. The U.S. also reduced its military assistance, though it didn't cut it off entirely.
Still, the end of international aid was the nail in the coffin for Somalia's economy. Inflation made it impossible for people to afford even basic necessities, and the country's GDP plummeted.
In response, popular unrest increased to an even greater degree. Berra reacted by once again suppressing dissent.
The bulk of the crackdown occurred in the northwestern portion of Somalia, home of the Isaaq clan and the rebel SNM organization. And this time, Berra's response backfired.
By 1988, the SNM was powerful enough to launch attacks on government strongholds in the northwest. Berra's control over the region steadily shrank until he held only the principal towns.
In early June, the SNM captured Hargeisa, Somalia's second largest city. The regime's counterattack was ferocious. government planes bombed the city indiscriminately and targeted Isaac civilians for mass execution.
Eventually, over 500,000 refugees fled to Ethiopia, while 90% of Hargeisa was destroyed. Meanwhile, the nation's third largest city, Beroe, was similarly targeted by Bera's regime.
70% of Beroe was eventually leveled. The death toll of the Isaac genocide was estimated to be as high as 200,000.
Despite the staggering destruction, Somalis were more inspired than ever to form other rebel groups. These militias now included thousands of deserters from the National Army.
With the economy in shambles, soldiers who were no longer receiving a paycheck became rebels instead. Others sold their guns for food, while some kept their weapons and turned to banditry.
Over the next 2 years, rebel groups steadily seized one town after another, while Bera terrorized those still under his dwindling rule.
In July 1990, 46 prominent Somalis were sentenced to death during a kangaroo court. Their alleged crime was circulating a petition calling for free elections and human rights.
The sentence sparked protests that paralyzed Mogadishu. The chaos forced Bera to overturn the conviction just days later, making a rare concession of defeat. While groups inside Mogadishu and countries like Italy tried to reason with Siad to transfer his dictatorship to a civilian government, he still wouldn't budge. But it was already too late.
By this point, Bera's control of the country had extended no further than the bounds of the capital. His enemies derisively called him the mayor of Mogadishu.
But even that was giving Bera too much credit. By 1991, Mogadishu was in a state of anarchy. Actual power belonged to various armed groups. Some were organized militias, others were looters scrounging for whatever they could. It was these looters who unwittingly instigated the final battle for Mogadishu.
On December 29th, a gang of looters composed of mostly former army soldiers attacked a store and killed the owner.
The sound of gunfire brought militias to the scene, who killed some of the bandits. The surviving criminals fled to gather reinforcements, along with a tank from their army unit.
As various militias poured men into the fighting, Bera finally lost control. He had few loyal troops left, and no amount of artillery could stop the militia warfare in the streets. After weeks of vicious battles, Bera fled the capital on January 26, 1991.
He retreated to the southwest of Somalia, which was still held by his son-in-law, the former Minister of Defense. From there, he crossed the border into Kenya.
He stayed in Nairobi for only 2 weeks. He was forced to flee again due to complaints that the Kenyan government was paying for his stay at a luxury hotel.
Bera then moved to Nigeria, where he spent the final 3 years of his life. He died of a heart attack on January 2nd, 1995, at nearly 85 years old.
As a boy, Siad Bera's family was devastated by factionalism and clan violence. He believed these ancient conflicts were primarily responsible for the country's woes. Because of this violence and his unstable upbringing, Bera dreamed of becoming a clever man with two hats. That is to say, the man in charge.
And for a time, he was the man in charge of Somalia. But any leadership success was overshadowed by totalitarian domestic policies and misguided conflicts abroad. And once these troubles threatened his regime, Bera embraced the same factionalism he claimed was tearing the country apart.
Members of his clan were promoted and pampered, while members of other clans were cast out of the government and later targeted for extermination.
Rather than eliminate factionalism, Bera abused his power and made it worse. The exacerbated clan divisions instituted a culture of hatred that haunted Somalia for decades.
Tragically, Barra's downfall and death still didn't bring peace to Somalia. The country descended into a civil war that continues intermittently to the present day. For Somalia, stability still remains fragile. Thanks for listening to Dictators.
You can find all episodes of Dictators and all other Spotify originals from Parcast for free on Spotify.
We'll see you next time.
Dictators is a Spotify original from Parcast. It is executive produced by Max Cutler. Sound design by Juan Borda, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Nick Johnson, Trent Williamson, and Carly Madden. This episode of Dictators was written by Devin Hughes, edited by Tony Goodman and Andrew Messer, fact-checked by Mary Mathis, researched by Bradley Klein, and produced by Bruce Katovich. Dictators stars Kate Leonard and Richard Rossner.